What followed was the most stressful tram ride home of my whole life, only to find the little guy alive and well. Just a bit annoyed that I'd interrupted his nap.
You're listening to All the Best. I'm Samantha Groth. On this episode, we're talking about the things people love, which might seem strange to the outside observer.
There's a line from the author Donald Miller that goes, "Sometimes you have to see somebody love something before you can love it yourself." I get that a lot. Just recently, a friend of mine was talking about Anne of Green Gables. I haven't read the books, and I think I saw the movie as a kid, but I don't really remember it. So she gave me an overview of the life of Anne Shirley, an overview of all 9 books in the series. She talked about what she loves about the character of Anne, how much the books meant to her when she first read them, how much they still mean to her now. And listening to that, I loved Anne of Green Gables. She showed me how. I still haven't read the books, but that is now another little part of the world that I can love. So for this piece, I've asked people to tell me about something they love, something they love that other people might not. You'll hear from 4 of them, talking about etymology, watches, rejuvenating old furniture, and the music of Felix Mendelssohn. They'll talk about what they love about that thing, what it means to them, their experience of it. Sometimes you have to see somebody love something before you can love it yourself.
I started collecting watches by accident, really. I had never been a person to have a particular collection of anything, and I didn't set out to collect watches, but it just happened watch by watch, accidentally, until I'd developed quite a collection. I developed my watches, collected them from all sorts of places. Some of them came from flea markets, some of them came from op shops, some of them came from travel. I was gifted some of them. They're all different. I love that. I have a wooden watch. I have analog, digital. And for me, there's something quite beautiful about having all these different watches, each of them that looks really different aesthetically. But they all function the same. They all tell the time. They all, in many ways, when you strip it back, it's a really basic item to have, and at the end of the day, they just tell the time. That's all they do. But for me, yeah, there's some sort of appeal with watches. I always assume, perhaps wrongly, but I assume that there's normally some sort of story behind a watch. Normally, it was given to someone for a special occasion, or perhaps it's an heirloom, perhaps it's something they saved up for. Normally, there's a story behind a watch, and I love that too. And that's certainly the case for my watches. Each one has a story. Each one's unique. Each one has a special memory associated with it or a special person. Yeah, I love that about watches. I did once go to an exhibition on watches, a museum exhibition, and it was really interesting. One of the things that struck me was that watches didn't used to be accessible for the masses. They were very much the domain of the upper class. And obviously over time that's changed and watches have become something that's accessible to everyone. You even sell them at $2 shops these days. You can buy toy watches, you can buy cheap watches, plastic watches, everything. But for me it was interesting seeing the progression through time and how watches had gone from something that typically only gentlemen wore. Women didn't even really have watches for many years. But over time, increasingly, they've become more accessible, more common everyday objects. And I love that. I love how they have changed over time, but in many ways, they function in exactly the same way. And the core, the core elements of them have remained pretty much the same. I think I will continue collecting watches forever, although perhaps not at quite the speed I've accumulated them over the past couple of years. But yeah, I certainly hope that I keep collecting watches over my life. Different stories, different memories. Yeah, I would like that.
Thank you.
Something I really love is the etymology of words. And that simply means just where words come from, how they've sort of evolved over time, what languages and what ancient languages they come from, and how that sort of influenced the way we use them today. And there are a lot of things I love about the etymology of words. I love that mundane words that we use every day, mostly thoughtlessly, can sometimes have such poetic and romantic roots that you sort of never know unless you really think about where the words come from. I think one of my favourite words is the English word to consider, the verb to consider. I think it's a word that we use almost daily, or at least very commonly. It's a very exciting word in English. But the roots are pretty beautiful. It comes from the Latin considerare, considero, considerare, which literally means to think with the stars. And suddenly you have this sort of beautiful poetic root of a word that no one really gives more than a thought to. So I really love that. I think another thing I really love about etymology is the connection that it gives us with the ancients. There's, in English, we use the word virile from time to time to mean manly or strong or powerful. And it actually comes from Proto-Indo-European. The word is vir or beard or beerda, depending if it's from Latin or classical Greek or Sanskrit. It's the same word in all three languages. And in all three languages, it means the same thing. It means a strong young man, a groom, a young soldier, or a powerful foot soldier. And I love that through understanding that the words we use every day, we understand that we're part of this sort of long tradition of human experience. We're part of this long and ancient web, and that my personal experiences in the world, my personal experiences that are understood by me through the words that I use are not new, and that I'm not alone there. That thousands and thousands and thousands, hundreds and thousands of years of humans have felt the same and had words to express the same. That's something I really love.
I absolutely love rejuvenating old furniture. When I say old, I don't just mean like antiques. I don't just mean something that might be 50 or 60 or 70 years old. I'm talking about things that are pretty much on the side of the road being thrown out. They could be in an op shop. They could be covered in dust. They could be scratched. They could have their surface peeling or worn and damaged. It could be a table with wobbly legs. It could be chairs with big cracks in them. Things that you might look at and think, you know what, that's had it. That's had its day. That really needs tossing out. I love finding something that I can visualize being beautiful again and having functionality and just being something that brings joy to me and hopefully joy to others. It's not just the end result that I love. I actually love working on it. I love being there with a paint stripper or a sanding machine or my tools and working away at it and seeing something little bit by little bit take on new life again. I am totally in the flow when I'm doing that. I'm probably, it's not the only time when I'm really, really happy, but I know that it's one of the times when I am just so totally in the flow, finding joy, finding happiness doing that. Probably one of the projects that has given me the most joy in recent times is making a console table. or a sofa table, as some people call it. I found a base and I painted it up in a charcoal colour, which, you know, brought it sort of into more contemporary times. And but the top on it, the timber on the top was pretty awful. It was cheap timber. It wasn't nice. It wasn't nice to look at. And I could visualize what I wanted to do. And I love oak. Oak's a beautiful timber. It's got an earthiness to it. It's got a casualness to it. But I think what I love most about it is that it's got a stunning grain to it. I love the grain of it. It's just warm. It's friendly. It's interesting. And I could imagine this console table with an oak top on it. And within a week or two, I found on eBay a broken table that was going for about $25 on the other side of Sydney. The legs were broken, but it had a solid oak top. And so we drove across Sydney and managed to bash off the broken legs, squeeze it into our car just, and bring home this tabletop. I stripped it back, I polished it, and secured it to the top of the console table. And I just love it. It's just brought me such joy. Bringing a console table that was pretty ordinary as well as a broken table together and creating something that I just love looking at. That's the sort of thing I do. That's where I find a lot of joy and satisfaction. That's what I love doing. I love using my hands, visualizing a change for the better, and rejuvenating something and reviving it, bringing it back, creating something that is lovely to look at and functional. That's where I find a lot of joy. That's what I love doing.
So I'm a violinist and I spend most of my time in music. And some of my favourite music is by a guy called Felix Mendelssohn. Now, most people haven't heard of Mendelssohn. He was a German composer of Jewish origin who lived in the first half of the 19th century. But I reckon they should have heard of Mendelssohn. For me, he's one of the great composers. I find his music moving and powerful like nothing else. Apart from which, he wrote most of it when he was a teenager. This piece, for example, he wrote when he was just 14. Two years later, at 16, he wrote what people have called his first mature work, The String Octet, which is a piece written for 8 string players. I first played it when I was a student about 4 years ago, and I still put it on whenever I feel in need of a smile. I've yet to find a piece that gives me more energy and more joy. Two years later, again, Mendelssohn wrote what I consider to be my favourite string quartet of all time, which means a piece written for two violinists, a violist and a cellist. It was his first foray into this genre. And in the second movement, which is kind of like the second panel in an artwork made up of four different panels, he writes what's called a fugue. A fugue is a clever musical construction in which each voice enters with the same tune. Now, normally fugues are pretty intellectual affairs, like a musical Sudoku. But this is the most viscerally evocative fugue I know. and it boggles me that it was written by an 18-year-old. For me, it is as though each voice is yearning, singing, imploring.
I love you so much, but I can't have you.
Speaking of emotional depth, it's not just Mendelssohn the child. Perhaps his most powerful piece was written just 2 months before his death as a requiem to the memory of his beloved sister, Fanny. I had the huge privilege of hearing this piece performed live by the group playing in this recording, that's Quatuor et Ben, in Switzerland last year, and I was rendered completely inconsolable. The passion, the pain, the grief, the anguish, the anger, the accusation, the strength. This music cuts and galvanizes me like nothing else. For me, Felix Mendelssohn is one of the great composers because he expresses so strongly and so sincerely so much of the human experience.
That story was produced by Joseph Ware, with help from supervising producer Tegan Nichols and Alison Chan. Special thanks to Martha Campbell, who spoke about watches. Ananya Chakravorty shared her love of etymology. Annette Ware talked about rejuvenating furniture. And Ben Adler spoke about his love of Felix Mendelssohn. You're listening to All the Best, and we're talking on this episode about sharing in what other people love. Something I always try to share with my loved ones is my love of the impromptu walk. I love just dropping everything when the thought occupies me to go. Walking through the suburbs or a new place with podcasts in my ears or a new album in a new environment or just catching up with a friend on the phone. It's just such a good way to get out of your head. You know, you're not getting from A to B. You're just walking and seeing the world. And it's a good way to get your steps up. One of our producers, Angela Moran, also likes walking. But she's not too sure if her cat's into it as well.
While experts seem to disagree about whether walking a cat is actually good for it or doing years of untold damage to its delicate psyche, the truth remains that the act of putting a leash on your cat and taking it for a walk like a dog the scene is a little weird, and I don't disagree with that. I wear bicarb soda as deodorant and pick up rubber bands off the street because I think they're handy.
Stay still.
Let's just say that I've never been one to shy away from doing something I wanted to do because I may be seen as odd. So when I adopted a four-month-old kitten last year, I was keen to harness him up and show him the world. Living in an apartment block with a locked entryway, there was no way for me to just let him out to come and go as he pleased like other cats. So I decided I'd do the honourable thing and make myself his chaperone. But the truth is, I nearly returned the tiny harness and lead I'd bought unopened after the first week. After all, it cost $26.95, and what were the odds that I could actually get my cat to want to wear it? I could have spent that money on something sensible, like pizza. But after the first week of being a cat mom, something inside me, probably guilt, decided the little tacker was ready to give it a shot. So with shaking hands, I cut the harness loose from its packaging, knowing that any hope of a refund was now lost. But you've got to spend money to make money, and it paid off. I now have a cat 1 year later who loves going on walks. I decided to call him Jason, after my dad's childhood horse, who ran free like a wild Brumby. like all stories with happy endings, ours hasn't been without its drama. Walking a cat is anything but a walk in the park. In fact, I've never taken Jason to a park. While I do take him out onto the street, we don't usually stray too far from our quiet suburban block. I've seen videos of cats being walked on a lead, and they're trotting along with a purpose, like they have a destination in mind. I bet that took some serious training. When I take Jason outside for a walk, he spends the first 10 minutes sniffing around the front garden. Then we skulk to the neighbour's place, where he does some more sniffing over the front gates and garage door. Then to the rosemary bush on the corner, into which he will climb, getting his lead all caught up in the branches.
Good boy.
While it may look the same, cute furry animal, on a lead, human servant in tow, in practice, walking a cat is very different from walking a dog. Walking a dog is a great way to stay fit. I've seen people in the park running alongside their dog, playing fetch and getting all active. Walking a cat, in my experience, is not really a form of exercise. Unless you count running from irate bird life, or crawling under broken fences because your cat's casually walked where you can't fit. Dogs are very confident social creatures who will happily greet people and other animals on the street. You can take them just about anywhere. Meanwhile, most cats are pretty wary of strangers when they're outside and don't usually want to get to know other animals. Case in point, the time we walked past a house where a cute little black kitty was making friendly meows at us. Jason, of course, aggressively hissed and walked off. I'm no expert on cat noises, but the other cat went, meow, and it totally sounded like disappointment. Jason usually heads in the opposite direction when he sees someone approaching us on the street, and thinks he's pretty clever when he tries to camouflage his grey fluffy body by lying in the cement gutter. If my walks with Jason have taught me anything, it's that when you take a cat out on a lead, it's still a cat, and will still behave like one. Like the time little kitten Jason decided to play with a bee on one of our pre-work walks. I wouldn't say I saw him get stung, but he definitely pounced on a bee that was buzzing around, and then he was licking his paw. So I put two and two together in the old anxiety oven and made a panic cake. Of course he was fine. He wasn't in anaphylactic shock when I left, and the bee probably didn't even sting him. But when I got to work, I googled, what to do if your cat gets stung by a bee, read the section about allergic reactions, and sprinted out of the office, blurting unintelligibly at my manager.
Oh my God.
What followed was the most stressful tram ride home of my whole life, only to find the little guy alive and well, just a bit annoyed that I'd interrupted his nap. Another fond memory I have is of the time we got attacked by magpies. The sun was shining, the magpies were wobbling, the leaves were rustling. Right above us. Yep, there was a juvenile magpie up in the nearest tree, and Jason was not about to ignore his feline instinct. He shot up that tree like a rat up a drainpipe, leaving me standing there with my arm up in the air, still holding onto the leash. The magpie began squawking like crazy, and pretty soon, Mama or Papa Magpie came to the rescue, and things got real swoopy. I distinctly remember being very aware of my tender, exposed armpit. I don't know whether it was the freshly applied bicarb soda on the underarm or just pure luck, but we actually avoided getting pecked to death after a few close swoops. Jason finally got the hint and backed his way down the tree, and I picked him up and ran for dear life back to the apartment. I've seen many thousands of dogs on walks with their owners in my lifetime, yet I have never seen one spontaneously climb a tree mid-stroll, harness on and all. Jason, meanwhile, loves to get in touch with his inner wildcat by scaling trees pretty much every time we go outside. In fact, the very first time I took him out on the lead, he walked over to the nearest tree, started clawing away at the bark like a scratching post, and shimmied right up the trunk in about 1 second flat. I was flabbergasted. Do I call the fire brigade? Poke him with a stick? Climb up there my bloody self? He eventually realised he couldn't get any higher and shimmied back down again. Now I can tell when he's going to go all koala on me, and only let him climb trees where he can't get caught up in the branches or climb up too high. At the end of the day, walking my cat has actually been a lot of fun. Sure, there's been stress, danger, and irreversible trauma, but I wouldn't take back the times I've had out in the field with Jason for anything. I truly think giving him some time outside to experience new smells, places, people and animals rounds out his life of sleeping, eating and biting my face really nicely. But I think I should give the star of the show the final word. What do you think, Jace?
That story was produced by Angela Moran, with help from supervising producer Beck Fari. And a special thanks goes to Jason the Cat. All the Best would like to acknowledge the traditional owners of the lands on which we make these stories and pay our respects to elders past, present and future. All the Best is made at FBI Radio in Sydney in association with SYN and 3RRR in Melbourne. Our executive producer is Alison Chan. Our Victorian State Coordinator is Beck Fari. Our Community Coordinator is Chloe Gillespie. Jordan Fennell is our SYN Community Coordinator. Tegan Nichols compiles the show. Matilda Fay is our brand new social media producer. And I'm Samantha Groth, your host. Shining Bird composed our theme music and Annie Hamilton designed the artwork. All the Best is heard across Australia on the Community Radio Network and is made possible by the Community Broadcasting Foundation. You can follow us on Facebook and Twitter, and all our other episodes are at allthebestradio.com. And you can express your love for All the Best by subscribing on your favourite podcast app.